Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now stop imagining and subscribe to the Planet Money podcast for stories about the economics of zoos, how the future looked 50 years ago, and more. Find Planet Money on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts, Jetpack not included. And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, for a remake of a TV series from the late 1980s, The Equalizer is making a pretty big splash and had the third highest opening weekend ever for a film from its star, Denzel Washington. We'll talk about how Washington found himself in this role and what this kind of movie does for and to his career. And then we'll shift gears to the 50th anniversary of the very silly but indelible Gilligan's Island. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And with us in the studio this week is Tanya Ballard Brown. Tanya, what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor and sometimes writer for NPR.org.
I have been reading some stuff of yours just recently. You just had a piece on the site on the Proto-Journalist blog. Am I correct?
Yes.
What was that about?
Second chances and do-overs.
Fantastic.
Cool.
Well, you have been with us many more than two times, but we are always happy to have you here. We wanted to talk a little bit about The Equalizer itself. I saw it, Stephen saw it, Glenn saw it. As I understand it, Tanya has not treated herself to The Equalizer quite yet.
Mm-hmm. You've not yet gotten equalized.
She hasn't gotten equalized. But we did invite Tanya in part because on past shows, she has expressed some Denzel Washington feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have Denzel Washington. And on Twitter, I've expressed some
absolutely
Denzel Washington
feelings. Absolutely, you have. What kinds of movies, what kind of roles, and what sort of vintage of Denzel do your Denzel feelings come from?
My Denzel.
You just got out a little book. And I like to think that that little book is exclusively for your feelings on Denzel Washington.
I think it just says Tanya Washington. Tanya Washington.
Exactly. I don't think Pauletta would take very kindly to that.
Your Idris Elba book is right.
Exactly.
Gigantic tome.
He is at least, he is not married. I can still dream
about
that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a scroll.
You know, he has a long time girlfriend though, so right. Not happening. My Denzel, the Denzel that I love is the Malcolm X Denzel.
Sure. Okay, sure.
Okay, and here's a reason why.
Oh, I say it again. You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run amok. This is what he does.
Denzel Washington, 1992.
There you go, had. Wait,
bamboozled.
There you go.
Yeah, that's great.
We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The new Denzel is, I don't know, Training Day was a turning point for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see why he took that role, because compared to the roles that he had played before then, there was just no redeeming quality in this man. So I can see why he took that role. I need something like,
yeah,
I need,
like,
he's 60, be a grandpa. I mean, I need, don't be Liam Neeson.
Well, that's what it is, right?
Yeah, that's
exactly
what it is.
What The Equalizer is. And mm-hmm. I think if you did see The Equalizer, for me, the thing that bums me out about his performance in The Equalizer is that his personality in film has always had a combination of the fiery personality and the stoic. He's mm-hmm. always had kind of a mix of both of those things. There is something kind of stoic and steely about a lot of those roles, but then there's also often a big rallying speech, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in The Equalizer, what you get is, I would be really curious to see how many lines he actually has in this movie, because I don't feel like it's very many. I feel like he is strong but silent to the point of almost totally silent. It's all stoicism. It's stoicism and murdering.
Yeah.
You know? You are
is
skipping.
It more murdering than the one he did with Ryan Reynolds?
I saw, you know, I saw the one he did with Ryan Reynolds, and I would say it's probably comparable murdering. I mean, it's, it is a very violent
I think it
movie.
Has more in common with Man on Fire.
Man on Fire, okay.
Yeah, well, let's,
which I just saw that one recently, honestly.
Well, let's talk quickly about The Equalizer. The Equalizer, it's a remake of a 1980s action TV show. Basically, it's the gentleman's guide to vigilante justice.
Yeah.
It's, he's a stoic, but he's also, he's a devout reader. And he talks about his love of reading and
the old man in the sea
and nutrition.
Yeah. And, he gives nutrition advice.
He's a motivational fellow. He's there for his friends, and when he's not, he's murdering. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of the Murdalizer after a certain point. But basically, it is set in this kind of horrible alternate universe in which almost everyone is terrible.
Yeah. Right.
And so it's basically setting the stage, very carefully setting the stage for a world in which he's the only one who can take care of these bad, bad people.
And it can only be done by just murdering
It can
them.
Only be done through murder.
I thought Beretta
murder.
Did that in the Death Wish one.
It's very
it's
Death
similar
Wish.
To that.
It's very Death Wish. The cops are corrupt. It's
a see, let's vigilante. Go back to Glory. Let's go back to Mo Better Blues.
Well, we will get to Devil in a Blue Dress. And
Devil in a Blue Dress.
You know that's my movie. No, I love him.
And we'll certainly get to that, but I mean, to quickly dispense with The Equalizer, it's this weird...
I think it's a very dispensable movie.
It's got this weird mix of, in many ways, it's a very amoral movie that is also incredibly moralistic.
Yeah, that's true.
It's got some good casting. It's got Martin Csokás,
he's
who
kind
is
of
great, who plays his sort of opposite number, who I didn't recognize until I realized he was Celeborn in Fellowship of the Ring. Without the blonde wig, tough to recognize. David Meunier from Justified. He plays Johnny Crowder on Justified. Mm-hmm. Great, great actor. Doesn't spend much time on screen because he gets killed pretty soon.
Yeah.
This movie, I liked it more than I thought I was going to, and then suddenly I didn't. It does something smart. There is, let's spoil this much, there is a slowly walking away from the explosion as it happens toward the camera scene, which, never again. Let's not do that.
I actually laughed out loud.
Yeah.
But what's smart about that is that before that scene happens, we get an establishing shot of a scene that we think is going to be the big finale of the film. This is where it's going to come down. And no, because it blows up. There's an entirely separate place where we go and spend a long part of the film having the big finale, which goes on too long. I think you chop 15 minutes off of that finale. This film needed a lighter footprint. It needed to get in and out really quick. You feel every one of its 2 hour plus minutes, and you shouldn't. This is not meant to be a contemplative deep movie. This is meant to be fun, and it just wasn't fun enough.
And it's got a couple of really nice, surprisingly subtle touches. There are several scenes in which the garrotings are implied rather than shown that are clever.
Yeah.
You know they've happened, but you don't need to see them happen. And in a movie that is so weirdly like loving in the way that it slaughters people, but I liked those subtler touches.
Where they didn't feel obligated
where they didn't
to show
feel obligated to very viscerally show viscera.
Right. Well, this goes back to, you know, one of the reviews of this movie on Slate said that the action movie genre doesn't serve Denzel well because it doesn't play to his strengths, which are, quote, vulnerability and droll humor. And I read that and I thought, which actor have you been watching for the last
Preacher's
two decades?
Wife. Yeah.
See, that's the, I didn't ever saw the
She's
Preacher's
Wife. That's exactly right. Tanya, like me, has a memory of a guy with a kind of a grin. There is more humor
but you have to
in
go
what
way
he was.
Back.
No, you do. You absolutely
you have to go back
do.
To Mississippi Masala.
It's been a. It's
you have
been
to go back
time.
To 1989 with a really great film he was in at the same year that he won for Glory. He was in this great little film called The Mighty Quinn, which is a mystery set on a fictional Caribbean island where he's the chief of police and his friend, played by Robert Townsend, is the chief suspect. He is charming. He is sexy. He's got an easy charisma there.
Well, now, I felt like he was all of that in The Inside Man.
Yeah, I didn't see The Inside Man.
Okay. He was, you know, this ain't no bank robbery.
But in 1995...
I like, by the way, that Tanya has seen every Denzel Washington movie except for The Equalizer.
Just give me time.
They've been out longer.
Slightly more recent example than The Mighty Quinn would be 1995's Devil in a Blue Dress. You talked about it already.
Oh,
well, you
yes.
raved about it already.
Yes.
You moaned about it already.
I was
going
to say, you mostly just sighed.
But, I mean, that's because that's a mashup of my favorite author and then this actor. So that...
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's directed by Carl Franklin. It's based on Walter Mosley's first E.Z. Rollins book of mysteries. It's a sort of a L.A. noir film that also has a solid mystery in the middle of it, but it also really takes on racism as this character would experience it in 1950s L.A. Head-on. It makes no apologies for it, and it's really good. And if Chris Klimek was in the studio right now, you would press a button on his chest, and he would give you his spiel about why that film should have started a franchise.
Yeah,
should
I
have
agree.
Started a Walter Mosley, Denzel Washington franchise.
I completely agree.
It did okay. It did
I saw it in the theater, but I can see how if you weren't already introduced to this, and you may not have enjoyed that.
Well, here's my theory. So I first came across Denzel in the television series St. Elsewhere, one of his first roles. Mm-hmm. From 1982 to 1988, he played Dr. Philip Chandler. That character was dignified, laconic, stoic, noble. And his main character conflict wasn't much of one. His main character conflict was he worked harder than everybody else. He had to try harder, which was a really good message to send in the 80s on television about black men, that they have to try harder.
Right.
It didn't give him much to do.
Right.
And it played to this sort of noble character. It would be great it would be great if he lived in a post-racial world where he didn't have to think about what kind of character he was playing.
Right.
Which is why when Training Day came along and he blew that image of him wide open, I think that's why it also had some of the energy it had. Because all of a sudden you know this is Denzel, and you think you know what he's about, and suddenly he's showing you something. He showed you something similar to that in Flight, where he has a redemption arc in that movie. And, you know, you can argue that he's playing some of that in The Equalizer. There's not much of an arc in this movie, but there's some.
Well, when I think about some of his defining characteristics that come through in a lot of different movies, and that somewhat come through in his public persona, there is a little bit of a testiness. There's a little bit of an irritability to him that is in the stoicism and in the speechifying and in the murdering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think, you know, for me, I was one of the movies that I was thinking about today is that I really liked him in The Pelican Brief, which is a movie that not a lot of people care about, but
I do.
That he was in with Julia Roberts, where it's a John Grisham adaptation where she plays a young woman who has sort of accidentally figured out a massive conspiracy. And she finds herself kind of on the run, as everyone in John Grisham movies used to. That was kind of his original template. He's moved a little bit on from that. But she finds herself on the run, and she befriends this newspaper reporter.
Grey Grantham.
And that is the role that Denzel Washington plays, who, interestingly enough, my recollection is that in the book, there was no indication that that was a black guy at all.
That was why he loved that. I think he talked about that, that it was sort of one of those parts that he took that was not expressly written for a black guy.
And it's one of the first roles that I remember seeing a black actor in that I thought, that specifically is a pretty well-known character, right? Because the book was very popular. That's a pretty well-known character for them to say, look, it really doesn't need to be a thing. It's just as good for it to be Denzel Washington as whoever else at that time. Mm-hmm. And I like him in that movie in part because it is an action movie, but it's mostly a kind of a thriller movie. It's mostly a kind of a run around and get away from bad guys by outsmarting them. And that's why, to me, seeing him reduced to, you know, small spoiler alert, a million ways to die at a Home Depot.
well, basically, Home Depot.
Because he works at Home Depot, essentially.
But it also devolves into incredibly violent Home Alone.
It does.
Home Alone is incredibly violent. Right. Yeah. But really.
But this is part of, and there is a really, I thought, really smart piece at Slate by Aisha Harris, who wrote about the state of his career and sort of saying that it seems unfortunate that it's been a long time since he did one of these more sort of fully developed roles. And the thing is, of course, you know, as Tanya mentioned earlier, what he's doing is the Liam Neeson thing.
Yeah.
And so it's almost like, in addition to the stratification of what's available to black actors, which has always been part of the story of his career, now he's also dealing with what's the expectation for a respected actor who is now 60.
Yeah.
You know?
He's a badass in dad jeans. He had some pretty bad
dad
jeans.
He's a good looking 60. I mean, he's not an old man looking 60.
He's a great looking 60.
You know,
but Chris Klimek, in his review that ran on NPR, pointed out that, and what he called the old Jedi, the celibate old Jedi, which is very much what this role is. It is the Liam Neeson role that he has done a bunch of times. I feel like that's not a good use of Denzel Washington. Yeah, I feel like you're leaving so much on the table in terms of his capacity to be sort of fun and not fun.
A fuller, richer.
Engaging. I feel as opposed to just glowering all the time.
Yeah, but America's getting older. By 2030, there's going to be 1 in 5 Americans over 65. You're going to see a lot more movies like Red and The Expendables and Taken. And you're going to see a lot more old Jedis. It's just the demographic is aging.
Yeah. I will also shout out, he made this joke to me in an email, and I think he will forgive me for passing it along. He said that he really wanted to see the guy who was in the French parkour movie Brick Mansions that Chris and I saw, and Denzel Washington and Seth Rogen make an action movie together so that they could call it Liberté, Equalizer, Fraternity.
Nice.
Which I thought was an exceptional joke.
There's some work involved.
Involved in that joke.
Well, keep in mind that it's somewhat like we lament, like, why doesn't Denzel Washington do more? I mean, Denzel Washington makes a lot of movies. And if you make a lot of movies, some of them are going to be mercenary throwaway movies. This was a commercially successful movie. Liam Neeson. Now, it's been a while, I feel like, since Liam Neeson was in a great, well, the Lego movie. Yeah. But you know, he hasn't had a Schindler's List in a while. He's mostly punching wolves.
Right.
Well, the other thing, too, that we have to remember, because for my birthday this year, I went to see him on stage. He's also doing other kinds of acting.
Denzel.
Denzel.
And Raisin in the Sun?
He was. He was doing something beyond, you know, that. There's no shooting in that.
Right.
You know.
And he got a lot of recognition for that role. And I think, as Stephen was mentioning, he makes a lot of movies, and it feels like it's been a long time, but then you think, you know, Flight wasn't long time ago.
There was Oscar buzz surrounding Flight 2 years ago.
He was nominated for an Oscar for Flight. The Taking of Pelham 123, the remake they did with John Travolta, not a movie that people thought of as pure throwaway junk movie.
And you do get some vulnerability there.
Yes, you do.
But you get, even in these last, yes, he's making Safe House, but he is making Flight, and he's making, you know, American Gangster and these other movies. But like when you look at his filmography, he makes still a lot of movies and works a lot.
The other thing we have to consider is we don't know what scripts he, you know, like what, we don't know. He may be choosing this among things that are worse.
Oh, I don't think it's a matter of critiquing his script choice process. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of are they finding the right things to do with him that take advantage of kind of all the capacities that he has. And it may be that because he's aging so well, like you said, he's such a good looking 60.
He is looking good.
That it's 60. Easy to forget that this happens to a lot of actors when they're 60. And as much as we think of it as happening to women sooner and more, it happens to dudes eventually that they stop giving you the same rich quality of leading roles that they gave you when you were a 35-year-old, almost unbearably hot dude. And I suspect that, as Tanya is saying, that he's experiencing some of that. What would you like to see him in, Tanya?
He's a dad. Let him be a dad. Let me see the softer side of Denzel. You know, we've seen a Lothario. We've seen, you know, Philadelphia. He was a family guy in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. Can he just be like a dad?
Like in Steve Martin type movies?
One time. You know, a dad with a daughter. You know, I don't know, Father of the Bride,
just
the black version.
Just be careful what you wish for.
But he's a dad in all the sort of... Or can we see a Family Stone with Denzel and some family?
Well, what you're saying is really you want to see him in something where you can feel a little affection for him.
Yes.
Well, no, wait. I've got an idea here. No, you put him in one of those movies with, you know, with family and everything, and then his family is murdered.
Sure. No.
And he has to go on a bloody rampage in order to avenge their death.
It starts off like Father of the Bride.
Does he, like, get off my lawn, like, in Clint Eastwood?
Oh, the Clint Eastwood. And then
hits all four quadrants.
Yeah.
Yes. It absolutely does. And so does he when he gets out his gun.
Are you a wolf or a sheep? Shoot program. 23-hour lockdown.
Well, as you can tell, Tanya does have some Denzel Washington feelings. And we hope maybe some of you have them, too. So come and find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on the blog at npr.org/PCHH. So the other thing we were going to talk about today, it came to my attention. I didn't even realize until NPR's TV critic Eric Deggans wrote a piece for Monkey See where he talked about the 50th anniversary of Gilligan's Island. And when we mentioned Gilligan's Island
just
to Tanya,
right back and we hear a tale.
In addition to her Denzel Washington feelings, Tanya had a story about Gilligan's Island.
So when I was 8, for my birth, my 8th birthday, my mother and her friend took me to the Pineville Dinner Theater outside of Charlotte to see Bob Denver in this play. And it was so exciting. And I got to meet him and he signed my program. And I took it to school the next day and was like, Gilligan signed my program. And nobody cared, but I cared.
But you were into this because it was Gilligan.
Yes.
You knew Gilligan. You knew Gilligan's Island.
Because it would come on. Like in the afternoon,
school.
Right,
yeah.
After school, and you...
That used to be a thing, if you're out there.
Right.
You're,
yeah.
There used to be a thing where, you know, you only had a limited number of channels.
Yep.
And we didn't have cable always. And you would have, like, your UHF channels, mm-hmm. which would be your higher numbered channels. In Philadelphia, your channel 17 and your channel 48.
And your channel 29.
And your channel 29, which is what Glenn is telling me Gilligan was on. Mm-hmm. And you would watch it in the afternoon. And that's where I knew the Brady Bunch from. And that's where I knew Gilligan's Island from. And so I think for all of us, our recollections of Gilligan's Island are sort of one generation removed.
At least. The amazing thing about it is that it ran for only 3 seasons. Mm-hmm. That's what struck me as I was doing my
really?
Digging down this wormhole today. And the first season was black and white, so they rarely showed it in syndication. So
right.
Everything you know, you think
is,
you know,
yeah.
is 2 seasons, which they were 30 episodes apiece. So we're talking about 60 yeah. episodes just cycling through. You churn through that if it's on 5 days a week. You churn through that in 3 months.
It's no wonder I feel like I've seen the one where they did the opera 100 times.
Absolutely. And if they do 2 episodes back-to-back, which Channel 29 did, it's like a mm-hmm. month and a half
right.
to see everything before it all starts churning through again.
Well,
yeah.
and that show feels like it went through this like late period decline, too, which is amazing. I feel like it's like, oh, yeah, in season 6, it really started. Once I started having all these guest stars, like I think
yeah.
of that show as having an embarrassing late period decline, and that would have been like, what, season 2?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Wow. It's true.
When I graduated from college, I had this degree, that useless degree in marine biology that I knew I wasn't going to use. I went to Europe and backpacked for a while, came back, started living with my parents, and spent the afternoons watching reruns of Gilligan's Island, which I tried to explain to friends and family was actually research, because I was convinced I was going to write a book about this, because I kept trying to convince them that the absurdity of the show was the point of the show, the silliness, the dumpth is, you don't get it, man, that's what the show's about. But it was part of this tradition of I Dream of Jeannie, Bewitched, My Favorite Martian,
Green
Mr.
Acres.
Ed, Green Acres, The Addams Family, The Munsters. This era in the mid-60s of pure absurdism as proffered up as entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the conventional wisdom, of course, is that people were just so freaked out by the Kennedy assassination and the Cuban Missile Crisis that they just said, anything but this. Let's make this very, very silly show. One of the things I did as I was researching my book, which I wasn't really researching a book, I was just hanging out at home, was I got Sherwood Schwartz's book called Inside Gilligan's Island from Creation to Syndication, which came out in 1988. I read this book 26 years ago, but there's this one moment that has crystallized in my mind because this taught me about the nonfiction unreliable narrator. This guy had no clue what was going on. There is this self-aggrandizing quality. He's old school Hollywood.
Sure.
He was a gag writer, as you might realize from the show. He was a gag writer for Bob Hope and Red Skelton. That's where he comes from. And there's this moment very early on in the book where he's describing the pitch meeting to the CBS suits. And he's telling them about the very first scene in the pilot where Gilligan runs off the deck of the Minnow and doesn't land in the water because they're on an island. He lands in sand. And then he proceeds to describe how that filled the room with peals of laughter, how people were just crying with just mirth. And comedy hasn't changed that much.
Yeah.
And that's when you realize... None of this happened.
Nothing.
Nothing. He yeah. is making all of this up. Or he has just remembered it so much that because he was convinced that this show was a microcosm of America. Apparently, William Paley, who was running CBS at the time, didn't know what the word microcosm was. So this fed his feeling of superiority, of intellectual superiority that was behind the show, Gilligan's Island.
Wow.
Well, yeah.
You know, it's funny. You talk about things not changing very much. There was a really interesting exchange went by on Twitter today that I kind of only passingly made note of until I started thinking about this conversation we were going to have. And they were talking, it might have been Alan Sepinwall, it might have been James Poniewozik, you know, people who talk about TV on my Twitter feed. And they were having a discussion about the show Selfie.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out on ABC. And they were sort of lamenting, well, the tricky thing is kind of nowadays... you have to have a short elevator pitch and a high concept and everything. It's, and I kind of was thinking about it later, like Talking Horse.
Yeah.
That was, that was Mr. You know, that's Mr. Ed. I mean, so many of these shows, like
it was
Lady Genie, two words.
Yeah. It was Alan Sepinwall who was sort of having at least part of that conversation, because I saw that too.
And I'm not busting on Alan Sepinwall.
No, of course not. And I think what he was talking about was sort of that we had passed through a period where comedies could be a little bit more general in their setup.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people in a bar,
right.
Friends in New York. Even the idea of a show about nothing like Seinfeld.
Well, that's four words.
You know, it could be a workplace comedy, right? News radio or stuff like that. They weren't described with these really pointed, the gimmick is this.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you're absolutely right that those shows now where there is a gimmick like that, like Selfie, or like this horrible comedy that they're starting called Manhattan Love Story, it's voiceovers, that you're getting character voiceovers all the time. I mean, I think Selfie, you can argue, is a return to the era of Gilligan's Island. And that's kind of something that I think didn't come up in that conversation, that this is really a hearkening back to where you had to have a single goofy idea, and that it's harder now to have a comedy where it's just, it's a workplace, it's a bunch of friends, it's a family. It has to have more of a goofy thing about it than that. So you are back in this, like, people stranded on a desert island, a talking car, a talking horse.
Well, and if the concept can explain itself in the name of the show,
yeah.
Like, you know, a la Beverly Hillbillies, which is another.
All she does is take pictures of herself.
and well, there you go. You just hit on the other point that I wanted to make, which is that this was a massive golden age of TV theme songs.
Absolutely.
Yes.
In which they explained everything in the show in more words than you would ever need to explain the show.
Right.
Green Acres is the place to be. Fun living is the life for me.
They're creepy and they're kooky, mysterious and spooky. They're all together ooky, the Addams Family.
Well, the first thing you know, old Jed's a millionaire. Ten folks said, Jed, move away from there. Said California is the place you ought to be. So they loaded up the truck and they moved to Beverly Hills, that is.
The ship set ground on the shore of this uncharted desert isle with Gilligan, the skipper too, a millionaire and his wife, a movie star, the professor and Mary Ann here on Gilligan's Isle.
The TV theme songs were so crucial to these shows, to the point where I'm not sure we would remember virtually any of them without the theme songs.
Gilligan's Island in particular, but a lot of these shows also, was the power of reruns. I mean, you internalized them as a kid because they just kept playing over and over again, and so much that they attained this power. There were three sequel telemovies to Gilligan's Island where they get off the island and they come back on the island. And the third and final one, which aired in 1981, is described thusly. Villains played by Martin Landau and then-wife Barbara Bain try to take over the island to gain access to a vein of supremium, a valuable but volatile element. This next sentence I'm going to read you is the best sentence you're going to hear today.
Mm-hmm.
They are thwarted by the timely intervention of the Harlem Globetrotters. Awesome. How awesome
Everything
is that?
Everything is better.
Everything is better.
And that was a movie. That was a movie. That wasn't a 30-minute
No, it was 2 hours. 2 hours on a Friday night. A Friday night, you say? Yes, yes, absolutely a Friday night. Who else is going to see that except people who are home on a Friday night? There was two cartoons, New Adventures of Gilligan and then Gilligan's Planet. Every time you take this...
Gilligan's Planet?
It was only lasted for 12 episodes, but trust me, 82 to 83.
Only lasted 12 episodes is actually quite a few episodes.
That seems like a lot of Gilligan's Planet to me.
But I feel like back then they ordered more.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But, I mean, like, you know, okay, so if you're asking me what's the best episode ever, it's season 3, episode 4, The Producer, where a Broadway producer, played by Phil Silvers, of course, arrives on the island. They try to convince him to take them back to the mainland.
To help them.
By staging a musical production of Hamlet set to the tunes of pieces of classical music that are in the Howells record collection by Bizet and Orphan Bach. So I'm a kid. My parents didn't listen to classical music. I never heard of Hamlet. This was my first exposure to both Hamlet and Bizet.
Neither a borrower nor a lender be. Do not forget. Stay out of debt. Think twice and take this good advice from me. Guard that old solvency. There's just one other thing you ought to do. To thine own self be true.
Amazing.
The entire time Linda was mouthing the words
of course,
and doing a
it's
finger.
Internalized, right? Mm-hmm. I got them all.
It's
They're
not like I've
there.
Thought about that in the last 20 years.
For the rest of my life, whenever I hear Carmen, whenever I... Whenever I hear Offenbach at all, whenever I think of Hamlet, that's what I see.
Yeah.
I see Alan Hale Jr. in a bad wig.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is that it doesn't discriminate on the basis of quality. When your brain sort of processes things that you experienced in your youth, mm-hmm. it does not sort out the ones that were not good.
Right.
It does
right.
not say, well, the Brady Bunch wasn't good, so we'll throw that away. It's still in there so that when you see somebody reenact a scene from the Brady Bunch, it has that weird feeling of...
This is in the canon.
Yep.
This is in the canon. This is in my head. This is part of the makeup of my... I don't even know. I don't want to say personality because I really hope it's not part of the makeup.
Marsha.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of part there. Of it's always there. One last thing that gets even weirder about that particular episode, directed by Ida Lupino. Lupino, who played against Humphrey Bogart in the film High Sierra. She directed like 40 episodes of television. Pretty awesome.
Yeah.
She's badass.
What were the other 39? I'm just curious. I'm just asking for a friend.
Well, it is interesting. One of the things I was thinking when we were talking about this kind of absurdist television of this period is that we don't really have shows like that anymore, except in animation.
Yeah,
right.
Uh-huh.
You could do at that time shows in live action that now you could do, but they'd have to be animated.
Yeah.
They'd be on Adult Swim.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be on something like, or on FX. Because like, there's
especially when you're talking about talking horses.
Because it's not necessarily like, or you could have that on Hulu or something like that, but it would be animated.
Mm-hmm.
It probably. You would not have... I think we got to a point where what people wouldn't accept was literal live humans running around on an island set.
Mm-hmm.
But Archer is extraordinarily
right.
silly. Something like Frisky Dingo is not any less absurdist than Gilligan's Island,
right.
necessarily. It's more sophisticated. I'm not saying Frisky Dingo is Gilligan's Island. I'm just saying in terms of ridiculousness.
Or more disemboweling.
We still have ridiculous shows,
sure.
but they're animated shows.
But that's key. Kids and parents watched Gilligan's Island together. Now kids have the Disney Channel, and parents stay the hell away from that.
Yeah.
Rightly so.
In the evening, when a show like Gilligan's Island would have originally been on, it would not have been on opposite 50 things.
Right.
So it was easier, I think, to get those shows that were kind of like, well, everybody can agree that this is a fine thing to watch. This is an okay thing to watch, and we'll all watch together.
Did I read recently that there are now no more blocks of Saturday morning
you
children's
did.
Programming?
You did. As a matter of fact, as of last weekend, the last, I think it was on the CW?
CW, yeah.
It was on
CW.
The
very last Saturday morning cartoon went the way of the dodo.
On broadcast TV.
But,
yeah.
I mean,
you can recreate it any number of ways.
There's a lot of stuff that's leaving broadcast TV, so it's not
right.
that big a deal because it's still all over cable.
But it does have that kind of...
It does have a wistful quality.
Yeah, well, there is that
the nostalgia of waking... You, like, schedule out your Saturday morning on Friday night,
with my
cousin, and you're like, okay, so tomorrow we'll watch this, and this.
Oh, my God. I have to get up in time for Looney Tunes and stop watching in time for the Smurfs.
Okay. Yeah. It is that weird feeling of seeing all of your routines of your youth sort of gradually taken apart. And it's not like they don't watch cartoons anymore,
right.
but they're so self-scheduled. It's not really sad. It's only sad because you have a personal attachment to things
well,
being
right.
done a certain way.
I'm only sad because a big part of my life is now obsolete.
Right.
Yes.
Well,
and,
exactly.
Yeah. And that's one to grow on.
Well, I think it's healthy as long as you know that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like, as long as you know all you're doing is saying, like, well, that's because I miss being 10.
Yeah.
Right,
you know?
Exactly.
Like,
it's not actually worse
that
you can get this stuff
worse.
On demand.
No,
and
it's not. It is absolutely not. And it is definitely not worse that Gilligan's Island is not on. I mean, let's face it. Gilligan's Island, the Brady Bunch, there was some pretty ridiculous stuff. But feel free to come and tell us what you think of Gilligan's Island and the Brady Bunch and all manner of other fantastic shows of this era. And that brings us to our final segment. What is making us happy this week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, sir?
A sudden ludicrous abundance of music to edit to. I have a folder in my iTunes that says music for editing, or actually, I'm sorry, it says ambient for editing, and it is full of a band called Stars of the Lid, this guy called Panthe du Prince, who does a lot of, it's all instrumental music of various stripes that is hypnotic without being distracting. And all of a sudden, within the last couple of weeks, say nothing of the fact that there's a new Thom Yorke album all of a sudden that went from not existing to existing to people forgetting about it in the span of like an afternoon. But three albums kind of all came out on top of each other. One is the score slash soundtrack to the movie Gone Girl, which is Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, who did the music from The Social Network. Movie scores in general are nice to edit to. There's a new album by Aphex Twin, Richard D. James's first record in 13 years, and that's much springier and more, it's a little bit more enveloping, but in certain settings that you can set it to the part of your brain where it's not distracting you. And the third is by a group called A Winged Victory for the Sullen, which is just a perfect, perfect name of
Stephen Thompsonist name I've ever heard.
It is the most Thompsonian band
really
ever. And it is actually an offshoot of Stars of the Lid, which is a group I really, really love. If people haven't heard it and are looking for enveloping, beautiful music, Stars of the Lid is great. A Winged Victory for the Sullen is a kind of an extension of that that is also very pretty and inviting and great for listening to while you're stuck on your laptop.
You can't listen to any kind of any music with words, right? Not when you're doing it.
Generally, no. Not if I'm editing words.
It's impossible. I see people out with headphones actually listening to music with words to writing, and I just don't understand what they are.
No, I can't write while people are talking.
Automatons, they're weird. Okay. There is a new show on American television that stars Will Arnett, Amy Sedaris, Alison Brie, Paul F. Tompkins, Aaron Paul, Patton Oswalt, Kristen Schaal, Stanley Tucci, Wendy Malick, J.K. Simmons, Margot Martindale, Wyatt Cenac, Maria Bamford, Wallace Shawn, and Stephen Colbert.
That show is Selfie.
And I don't know who the casting director is for this show, but looking at this list, I am forced to conclude that it's me. I have somehow willed this show into being. Now, this show is, we talked about cartoons, we talked about talking horses. This show is an animated series called BoJack Horseman, streaming on Netflix. Now, I see your eyes kind of glazing over there, Linda, but stay with me. There's only 12 episodes so far. It's a story of a horse who starred in a cheesy 90s sitcom, and he's trying to make his comeback. He's bitter, he's bloated. It's very, very funny. It's very, very dark. I love it. BoJack Horseman.
BoJack Horseman. Thank you, Glenn Weldon. Miss Tanya Ballard-Brown, what is making you happy this week?
I'm going on vacation.
Always good.
So I can get away and I'll lay on a beach with my mother. It's her birthday on
fabulous
next week. And she's forcing me to take her on this trip. She wanted a party. I whittled it down to a trip because the party was going to, you know, she wanted like the red carpet, the Oscars. And so I'm going to do some reading because I have a chance to. And books I'm taking with me. One is Rose Gold, which is the newest Easy Rollins mystery by Walter Mosley.
There you go.
Now, I'm taking that because I've had it on the shelf for maybe at least 2 weeks now. And I happened to look at it today and realized that it was the latest Easy Rollins mystery because I had not paid attention. I just knew it was the Walter Mosley book. So I've read all of them. And that's why I'll be reading this one. The next book I'm hoping to read or at least get started because this is a book club read is The Warmth of Other Suns by Isabel Wilkerson.
Oh, fabulous. I have not read that, but I've heard it's wonderful.
Yes, about the Great Migration. It's been recommended by many people, so I need to get on that because I do believe our meeting is pretty much as soon as I get back to here. So I need to get right on reading that.
Thank you very much, Tanya. I have a few little things. Since the last time we taped a podcast, it was officially announced that our dear pal, Glenn Weldon, and many of you already know this, is one of 24 people in the entire country who were picked for the Amtrak residency.
Yay! Spirit fingers!
So that is a, if you read the, if you read the collection of writers, that's a pretty esteemed group. And I could not be more excited. And finally, you're getting the recognition that you deserve.
Oh, you're nice.
I'm very, very happy about that. Along similar lines, our friends at Code Switch, who a lot of you know and have heard on this show many, many times, won an award this week, an online journalism award for commentary.
Yay.
We were very happy for them. Also the visuals team at NPR and Planet Money, but they've never been on our show, so whatever, suckers.
So they can stuff it sideways.
Whatever, suckers. And one other small thing, we learned today that Roxane Gay, a writer that I have talked about before, is going to have her own vertical at The Toast, a site that we have talked about before. And her vertical is going to be called The Butter.
I love it.
Which I think is great.
I love it.
I love it too. And Roxane is not only a terrific writer, but somebody who I think giving her resources and editorial freedom and all that stuff, which she can get from The Toast and from Mallory Ortberg and those people, I think is just a fantastic development. It's one of those things that goes beyond a writer getting a great gig. It's a writer getting space to be editorially free to do the things that she's interested in. So I thought that was fabulous. In terms of an actual thing that I have enjoyed, I read a little romance novel this week called The Love List. It is by Eve Devon. I mean, it's a very romance novel setup. It's a woman and she's very busy at work and she has been running the family company and her sister is involved with this kind of no good dude and the no good dude's brother comes to town to try to make arrangements for the sister and the niece and they meet and it's a really charming little book. It's exactly the kind of romantic book that I just enjoy reading. It has good dialogue. It seems to be adults in this story who do not spend the entire time pretending that they don't like each other, which I think gets old. It's a very sexy book. It is not to give to your sort of easily shocked, I don't know, fellow readers. And I liked it. It's a terrific read and I enjoyed it a lot. Again, it's called The Love List by Eve Devon. And I can always recommend romance novels, but this happened to be one that I very much enjoyed reading that I had a galley of. And I love an e-galley. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. And you can follow Tanya at T-double-B. That's T-double the word and then the letter B. And you can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. That's R-E-E-D-Y. And our producer, Nick Fountain, at Nick Fountain. Nick like Nick, Fountain like Fountain. And as always, you can follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. Imagine you could call up a friend and say, meet me at the bar and tell me what's going on with the economy. Now imagine that's actually a fun conversation. Now stop imagining and subscribe to the Planet Money podcast for stories about the economics of zoos, how the future looked 50 years ago, and more. Find Planet Money on iTunes along with other NPR podcasts, Jetpack not included.